talk tonight is called Making Peace with Pleasure and Pain. A non-trivial topic, I think. though today, we might be like, whatever, I'm good, I can deal with pleasure and pain. Because, you know, I mean, this is about as nice a weather day as you could possibly get, right? And the aspen leaves are kind of clattering in the gentle breeze, and the grass is swaying, and I have noticed there's very few birds here. I'm really into birds, and most of the birds are gone already, which is definitely a harbinger of things to come, but we're not there yet. Today was, in the Buddhist world, we might call it a day from the heaven realms. So again, Mary is just kind of reporting that people are really, really connecting so well with nature and just enjoying the view at Discovery Point or enjoying the lying down meditation. So I'm really glad. So making peace with pleasure and pain. Actually, Buddhism says that there are heaven realms. This is the Buddhist cosmology filled with deities. But that's not the best realm to be born into. Because in that realm, there's so much pleasure. Who cares? Who needs to look for something deeper? The Buddha said that the human life is the best life to be born into because there's the right mix of pleasure and pain. There's enough pleasure that we don't get discouraged, but there's enough pain to make us actually look deeper. And it's, again, in the cosmology, it's only in the human body, which is racked with pleasure and pain, it's only in the human body that we can fully awaken. So pain in the Buddhist world serves a very constructive, important context. And we don't usually think of pain as anything positive, but it's really good that we can experience pain. It's a survival strategy wired into our nervous system. If we didn't feel pain, we'd just be hanging out with our bud and just chilling and leaning on the hot stove and putting our hand right in the burner, and just we wouldn't move it until we smelled the charred flesh. So pain is good from that perspective. Pain keeps us actually alert to what's happening around us. But there's a problem we have with pain. And I kind of like to say it this way. 2,500 years ago, the Buddha-to-be, in nature, out in the woods, the Buddha-to-be sat under a tree and solved your problem. He solved my problem. He solved Mary's problem. He solved his problem. He solved the conundrum of the human condition. You might just think for a sec, what's the most basic problem that we have? Way more basic than, did you get your tax refund? Way more basic than how it's going with your partner or your family or your coworker. Much more basic. What's the basic conundrum of being human?
Everything changes.
Suffering. Someone said.
How do I feed myself so I can stay alive?
So just mere survival.
Yeah.
Is a basic conundrum. And someone said.
Everything changes.
That's a conundrum. So all three of those have something very much in common. And what they have in common is our conundrum is we base our happiness on pleasure. But pleasure comes and goes. So whether it's the search for food, we suffer, you know, when we don't have food, when we don't have the pleasant experience, because it's all changing. So this is our basic conundrum. On a day like today, you know, it is the second day of retreat, so I get it that not everything is going your way. Even on the 30th day of retreat, that would be true. But, you know, we're in some ways still adjusting to being on retreat. But it was so pleasant today. Oh, my gosh. So we know how to be open and relaxed and at ease when it's pleasant. Could you have the same easy, relaxed, open attitude in a downpour? And let's say you even had really good Gore-Tex rain gear. You're covered, so you're not even getting wet. Could you have that same kind of easy going, you know, life is pretty wonderful if it was pouring rain. It's much harder, isn't it? We love being open, right? We love being open-hearted. But we base it on only a third of the slice of the pie, which is pleasantness. But we also get unpleasant, and we also get neutral. So the trick of Dharma practice is to be able to be just at ease in unpleasant experiences as you are in pleasant, just at ease in neutral experiences. So here is kind of our business as usual. This is a satire on the... Is it Hakuin who painted the great, the famous picture of the wave and...
Hokusai,
thank you. So this is a spoof on the Hokusai. And I'll pass it around so you'll be able to see it. But it's got the fisherman in the boat, and it's got this big, huge wave. But it's got Cookie Monster eyes, and in the middle of the wave is a cookie. And it says, "Today, me will live in the moment. Unless it's unpleasant, in which case me will eat a cookie." So, that's kind of how we are. I will live in the moment as long as it's pleasant. I can go to spa day and finally maybe get in the moment, you know. But then the avocado cream or the cucumber, whatever, you know, they're a little too chilly, you know. So even spa day is not quite doing it, you know. So... Okay, how do we be at ease no matter what? That's basically the riddle of the human condition, because we're wired to want to be happy. It's our basic drive. Everything we do in some way, even though sometimes it doesn't look like it, in some way everything we do is this drive for well-being. So I'll just tell you a little story. I was on retreat at IMS, Insight Meditation Society in Massachusetts, and Susan O'Brien was one of the teachers, and she was giving a talk. And at IMS, it's out in the woods of Massachusetts, and rural Massachusetts, beautiful woods, and these old beat-up roads all around, kind of going through woods and farm country, and there's manure trucks all over the place, just manuring the fields, so you have to watch out for the manure. And there's a pond, there's a walk called the Loop, which is a 3-mile walk, which is a perfect kind of after lunch walk to do on retreat on these back roads. And about 2/3 of the way along the walk, there's this beautiful pond, Gaston Pond. And so Susan was on the retreat I was on, was telling a story about being on retreat herself. And she was wearing a white blouse and maybe, a white skirt, probably something whitish. And she was sitting there. And then she kind of looks, she's just enjoying the pond. You know how it is on retreat. You kind of get into just looking at water rippling, right? And then she looks up and she sees Kelsey, this dog, who's a neighborhood dog, but who comes to IMS all the time and just gets so much love and metta from the yogis, because finally, you have a being you can look in the eyes and touch and even talk to. So Kelsey is this beloved dog at IMS. So Kelsey runs up and just kind of jumps into the lake. And then she realized, though, as Kelsey was heading towards the lake, that his nice kind of auburn coat was just covered in cow poop. And he dove into the pond and then came out, and then he did what all dogs do. He shook off all the water, and it just covered her with runny cow manure. And she said, "Unpleasant." Now, this is just a little nudge towards wisdom. Instead of, unpleasant, if you just heard the word unpleasant, you're not going to have some big catastrophe in your head, right? If you heard her say, "Yeah, Kelsey, covered in manure, wet manure, splattered my white dress and, my hair with cow manure," you would definitely think catastrophe. But when you say unpleasant, it's not so bad. And so this is a pointer to how we can be at ease no matter what's happening. And the pointer is mindfulness, because that's a mindful response. Unpleasant. Now, I don't know how she said it. I would have said it. Unpleasant. That's where mindfulness comes in and just keeps it really simple. We were talking about in group today, and one person was saying, "Oh, practice, isn't it a little bit like you sort of have all the ingredients lying out, but you don't cook them into some big frittata?" Right? So mindfulness allows you to just kind of leave everything as it is, where it is. It's just unpleasant. It isn't a catastrophe. It's just unpleasant. And I have a student who has a really difficult relationship with her teenage daughter. And she doesn't meditate very much. But she came to group one day where I gave a talk on this pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. And just if you can just keep it simple, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, it's a lot easier. So she learned to start saying unpleasant in her house, in a relationship with her daughter. And she didn't meditate very much, and I didn't see her for a while. And months later, she came back and just shared in the group that just to take the concept, even without much meditation, but just to get it, that the nub of it is unpleasant when it's unpleasant. The rest is a big story and drama. If you can keep it simple, it becomes more workable. So with mindfulness, we can keep it simple. And mindfulness is this curious, balanced, open state of mind. And it comes with this knowing what's happening. All of that comes together. Curious, open, balanced, and knowing. With mindfulness, we're able to face whatever's happening. And so we could say the answer to the question, how do I be at ease no matter what? The answer is, learn to replace reacting to your experience with being curious about it. Period. You could say that's the whole of the path. That's what we're doing. Again and again and again. We're just waking up to this question. What's it like? This question is Ajahn Sumedho, who's a very, very senior monk in the Thai forest tradition, a Westerner who ordained back in the 60s. That's one of his fundamental practice questions. What's it like? That's relationship. We're actually relating to our experience. What's it like? Oh, it's like this. It's like this. So, I just want to echo what Mary said this morning about mindfulness. The secular mindfulness movement is really, really cool in a lot of ways. I was just recently taught mindfulness to 20 judges in the Colorado juvenile justice system. And the whole workshop we did, a meditation student who's done actually retreat here at Vallecitos is a judge. And it helped him so much in being a better judge and dealing with the stress and actually being more clear and more fair. And so we taught mindfulness to judges. So I don't really want to knock this movement at all, because it's just becoming so mainstream now to bring mindfulness, whether it's education, you know, judges, lawyers, police even are starting to learn mindfulness. This is a good thing. I've always heard that there's a mindful poker approach. Because maybe the meditator's face, it's a good poker face. I don't know. But there is. I looked up online, so I read it on the internet, so it's true. There is a mindful poker approach. But remember, the point of mindfulness isn't to be a better poker player, a better golfer. It's to deal with this conundrum of being human. It's to deal with, can we stay open as life throws its slings and arrows at us. The muck and the mud and, you know, the beautiful and the ugly. How do we stay open? And every single one of us, this is our situation. Things go well, we're happy. Things go bad, we're stressed. And then it links up with our unworthiness. And we don't just feel bad about what's happening, we feel bad about ourselves. So it's you know, we really need an answer to this question. How can we be okay no matter what? It's a huge question. So the Buddha said this about mindfulness. This is the direct path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of pain and grief, for the attainment of the true way, for the realization of nibbana. That's what it's for, to free your heart. And we can talk about nibbana, the big E, capital E, enlightenment, but it's much more immediate than that. It's practical. It makes a difference right away. So the mindfulness that we're teaching here is not spirituality light, L-I-T-E. Here's a cartoon. two women jogging, and they've got arm weights to help it. And one is saying to the other, if you really had to choose, which would it be, enlightenment or buns of steel?
A conundrum.
That's a conundrum also, another human conundrum. Mm-hmm. Or six-pack abs, you know. So the point of mindfulness is freedom. Freedom of heart, which just means the ability to be at ease no matter what. So I referred to this last night, or yesterday, and Mary did as well this morning, that the Buddha's teaching on mindfulness, the main teaching he gave is called the Four Establishments of Mindfulness. It's called the Satipatthanas. And in that, he described the obvious, be mindful of the body. And it's not just our body, it's be mindful of everything physical. Be mindful of the physical world. That seems pretty obvious, something to be mindful of. He also said, be mindful of mind. Be mindful of the sixth sense, which we've been talking about, everything happening in your mind. That's pretty obvious. He also talked about a third establishment is called mindfulness of dharmas or dhammas. And it's just basically some of the Buddhist teachings, seeing the structure of the teachings in your practice. So the five hindrances, the six sense bases, etc., on up the seven factors of enlightenment, on up to the Four Noble Truths in full enlightenment. So that's the foundation or establishment of mindfulness as well. So body, mind, and then applying the Buddhist teachings, right? Three sort of obvious ones. The fourth is called vedana, or feeling tone. It's this, and feeling tone is the qualities that every experience has of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. So every sense experience through your five physical senses, sight, sound, taste, touch, smell, and through your sixth sense, thoughts, emotions, perceptions, memories, all are laden with feeling tone, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Every thought is pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Every emotion, every sensation. And I personally am like so happy about hearing this teaching, because it's to me, it is the rock bottom issue in life. And so he featured it as one of the four things to be mindful of. It's so important to be mindful. It's just as important to be mindful of body and mind and Dharma teachings. Just as important as that is to be aware of this quality of pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, because it's where all the trouble starts. So I'm just so grateful that he boiled it down to something so simple. And it's sort of like, well, duh, right? I mean, once you hear it, it's like, duh. But you know, life is very complicated. And so to me, it's just remarkable that it's boiled down to something so simple. The nub of our problem is how we're relating to pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. Period. It's our relationship with pleasant, unpleasant, neutral that is either our suffering or not. And so our reactive relationship with pleasant, unpleasant, neutral is, we all know this. What's our reactive relationship with pleasant? Grabbing. I want more. Yeah.
Happy.
Yeah. What is our reactive relationship with unpleasant?
Aversion.
Aversion. Don't want it. And what is our reactive relationship with neutral?
Bored. Don't care. Bored, don't notice.
Exactly. So the Buddha said that the three root afflictive mind states are these states of greed, aversion, and delusion. Greed for the pleasant, aversion to the unpleasant, and delusion, just not noticing the neutral. That's our reactive relationship to it. What's our non-reactive relationship? Mindfulness, curiosity, openness, equanimity. So our practice is about coming out of greed, aversion, and delusion and into mindfulness, equanimity, openness. And then this is very important. Enlightenment is not about transcending pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. According to the Buddha, your life will always be pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. Unstoppable. That's not the way out. The way out is not the heaven realm, where it's only pleasant, because that won't happen. No matter how rich, famous, successful, good-looking, youthful, powerful you are, your life is still pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. Just ask Beyoncé. You know. Ask Jon Stewart. Is his life still pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral? Bruce Springsteen didn't directly answer my question, but he did answer a question in Rolling Stone a few years back, talking about Making Darkness on the Edge of the Town, which was his second big album. And it was right after Born to Run. He had made the cover of both Time and Newsweek, and I think he was maybe the first rock and roller to ever do that, or the first person, I don't know. But, you know, basically, remember, we're all old enough, right, to remember that, Born to Run, the 1976. I think we're all old enough for that. No? Okay. Okay. I don't want to be ageist, excuse me. So here's what he had to say about how he was doing at the peak of his fame. At that age, my life was 100% music, and I had a very distorted relationship with it. It was my one shot at redemption. Redemption from what? I couldn't tell you. A thousand things, but it was my life preserver. At the time, working and playing made me happy. But the thing that was the most difficult was that I was very drifty. I didn't have a place. I never felt at home, even when I was home. I had no inner sense of home. The closest I could get to it was the band and playing. Whenever I wasn't doing those things, I was spiritually and emotionally wandering, really adrift. I couldn't get my feet on anything solid. Okay. I think there was a lot of pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral happening. Maybe a lot of pleasant. And he said, I couldn't get my feet on anything solid. It's all changing. It's always changing. We don't get out of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, and we don't get out of impermanence. So Andre Agassi kind of echoes this whole thing in his autobiography, Open. He said, fame is a force. It's unstoppable. You shut your window to fame and it slides under the door. I turn around one day and discover that I have dozens of famous friends and I don't know how I met half of them. I marvel at how unexciting it is to be famous. How mundane famous people are. They're confused, uncertain, insecure, and often hate what they do. It's something we always hear, like that old adage that money can't buy happiness, but we never believe it until we see it for ourselves. So, that's not the reliable escape route. It doesn't get us out of pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. pleasant neutral is unstoppable, inevitable. Greed, aversion, and delusion is optional. Put more simply, pain is unavoidable, suffering is optional. So here's what a very senior monk, Bhante Gunaratana, is he still alive, Mary? Isn't he? He's like 90 or something. He was a monk. I think he was ordained in his teens, very young, and leads the Bhavana Society in West Virginia, Sri Lankan monk. He has this wonderful book, Mindfulness in Plain English. And in it he wrote, "You can't ever get everything you want. It is impossible. Luckily, there is another option. You can learn to step outside the endless cycle of desire and aversion. You can learn not to want what you want, to recognize desires but not be controlled by them. You want something, but you don't have to chase after it. You fear something, but you don't have to stand there quaking in your boots. This mental cultivation is very difficult. It takes years. But trying to control everything is impossible. The difficult is preferable to the impossible." So that is our practice. Our practice, it's super simple. Just notice this half breath, this footstep, this bird song, that's all it is. But it's really hard, because we're so in the habit of being distracted. But we can do it, and people do it. You're doing it. The difficult is possible. And it's definitely preferable to controlling everything. So I'm just going to keep repeating this like a mantra. The path is replacing reactivity with mindfulness. It's replacing greed, aversion, and delusion with mindfulness. So here's a cartoon of Hulk. It's a very good drawing of Hulk. And he's meditating. He's in the classic kind of yoga mudra. He's meditating. And he says, "Hulk, no smash. Hulk, no smash. Hulk, maybe smash a little." He's trying hard with this meditation not to be reactive, not to be aversive. Hulk, no smash. Hulk, smash a little. So it's hard to replace reactivity, no smash, with smash. You know, it's hard to replace smash with no smash, is what I meant. Right? But at least it's very clear. If you think enlightenment is a mystery, and it is, but one really simple way to think about it is this. You know you're free when you truly don't care if the next moment is pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. That's being really free.
Would you repeat that?
You know you're free when you don't care if the next moment is pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Right? Because we, at that point, have basically sort of meditated out of the human conundrum. A fly is like landing on my face just to test my equanimity as I'm saying all this. Practice what you preach. Okay, I'm just noticing. Unpleasant. Shoe fly. Boy, it really wants to be on my face. Tingle, tingle. So this is freedom, right here, right now. You're okay even though you have knee pain. You're okay even though there's an itch on your shoulder, even though there's a fly on your face. Why are you okay? Because you're being mindful of it. It's back. And it's on my glasses. Oh, it's on my nose. Unpleasant. Oh, it looks unpleasant. So, this is more than just stress reduction. As good as stress reduction is, it's more than just being calmer. It's about being free. You're carefree. Why? Because you can handle the nub of life, the crux of it, which is pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. So, feel good. We talked about this in our groups today, about working with unpleasantness. A lot of you have been working with it. And on the one hand, I feel compassion and I'm sorry. And on the other hand, I'm like, cool. You get to work with it. Because even if it's just not scratching an itch and being mindful of it instead, that's a powerful training. It's a powerful contradiction to how we're normally trained. That becomes not scratching the itch, then becomes the metaphor that then we literally start changing our life. Because we can actually become mindful of the disaster instead of getting swept away by it. Oh, that's great. So I had knee surgery the end of July, meniscus surgery, and as surgeries go, it's really on the mild side of things. But I tore my meniscus. My knee was pretty sore from doing too many of my sports things into my middle 50s. I guess I was doing too much of being 56. And so it got more and more sore. So I laid off soccer, golf, hiking, like almost everything, and it started to get better. And I went and did a month retreat at Spirit Rock in February. And the second day of retreat, I couldn't do like the low impact things for exercise, like elliptical machine or biking. So I went on a run, and I tore the meniscus in my knee, at the very beginning of retreat. So I worked with a lot of unpleasantness on retreat. And then I got off retreat and talked to a surgeon, and sure enough, I had a torn meniscus. And so I waited a month just to see if it might heal a little bit on its own. It didn't. So then I tried stem cell therapy, which is this whole, if you haven't heard about it, regenerative medicine where you can, with stem cells possibly regenerate injured tissue. It didn't work for me, but I had to wait almost 3 months to find out that it didn't work. Mm-hmm. So then I did the surgery. I was definitely anxious about the surgery because I'd never had surgery. I didn't know what it was going to be like. And it was such a weird, trippy experience, like being wheeled into the OR. And then the next moment is my sweetie, my partner Lisa, saying, "You did great, you did great." And that was the next moment in the recovery room. It was just like, blah, 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 blah. But my recovery has been really slow, and the doctor is saying that it's probably because your brain basically is imprinted on this being in pain. And so it's interesting to hear an MD basically kind of say, it's just in your mind. Which she didn't say it in a patronizing way. She said, yeah, you've just been on this injured knee so long that there's a condition called central sensitization where the brain, it's sort of like the phantom limb syndrome where your brain thinks it's receiving pain signals when it isn't. So anyway, that's maybe part of the slow recovery. But what I've noticed a lot is a lot of reactivity to the pain. So the pain itself in the slow recovery, is 2, 3, and 4, never more than 4. on a 1 to 10, so on the milder side. But my reactivity to it, you know, after like 2 or 3 weeks, and I have friends who've had the same surgery, literally 6 people I've talked to who were walking within a week. You see me 6 weeks later, I'm still using crutches some. So 2 or 3 weeks in, I really started spinning doomsday scenarios, like, you know, she messed up, she didn't tell me the truth, you know, like, I'm headed for knee replacement, you know, and all of that stuff. And I would, you know, sometimes spin out for like a good part of a morning, just being really despairing about it. And, you know, what was I doing? I was making a frittata, you know. I was baking this big, very miserable, unpleasant tasting cake, you know, of like, this is disaster. And I truly just didn't know how this was going, because I was seeing literally zero progress. I mean, I came in after 3 weeks and with crutches, and the surgeon's like, what are you doing with crutches? I said, I can't walk without them, you know. So she said, oh, you shouldn't be on crutches. And I said, well, I am. So the story some days would really get a hold of me, and I would really feel despairing. So what I was doing, which is what we all do, is I was taking unpleasant sensation, and I'm creating a whole structure of time. This has been going on 6 months. So the 3 or the 4 in my knee, in my mind, was like a 7 or an 8 or a 9. Like despair, right? That's a pretty, you know, strong emotion. So it was much worse in my mind than in my knee. And meanwhile, now my knee's been healing up. You know, I'm really making progress. That I could do that hike yesterday was awesome. Even if I was on the crutches and a brace. It was literally my first hike in 6 months. So we need to have a lot of compassion for our greed, aversion, and our delusion. Of course we go there. If you didn't go there, you'd be fully enlightened. So if you're not fully enlightened, then I know you've got a lot of greed, aversion, and delusion going on, you know. And I tell you, I've got a lot of greed, aversion, and delusion going on. I'm not there yet. But I'm on the path, and that's everything. So we're doing our practice here a lot in connection with nature. So I just want to talk about waking up to pleasant, unpleasant, neutral with our practice in nature. So the Buddha awoke in nature, lived in nature, taught in nature 45 years. This tradition of connecting with nature is very strong in our tradition. And nature is really an intensification. So here in this quiet room, it's pretty pleasant. The temperature's set, the light, you know, isn't too bright or too dark, hopefully. You know, we don't have a ton of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral outside of us here in the room. It's all in here. But out there, we get these intense experiences of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. A day like today, we're just in love with life. We could literally watch water moving over rocks for a long time, right? Or we could just sit up on Discovery Point and just look at the sky. Maybe a raven going by. It's so nice. And anything can happen. We're in the mountains, so you know, we have days that start out like today and then end up in raging thunderstorms. And so in nature, when we're practicing in nature, we get this intensification of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. And as long, you know, we get so inspired by the beauty But we have to get it that the beauty, you know, comes with all of the thunderclouds and the thunderclaps and the floods and the disasters. It's just the way nature is. So when you're mindful in nature, and we're going to focus on feeling tone tomorrow. We're going to continue with body and breath today, but tomorrow we'll start focusing on being mindful of feeling tone, taking the Buddha up on his instructions. And then you'll have a chance to be on your own in the afternoon, hiking in nature. So, of course, it could be morning. We have to check the weather. We'll let you know tomorrow. But so you'll be working with pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. Hopefully, that you'll be really interested in taking that into your nature practice in the afternoon. So, because the pleasant, unpleasant, neutral is so, you know, intense in nature, you learn a lot. You even learn about insights into relationship in nature. For instance, if you were to really study praying mantises and know their life cycle, then you might appreciate the humor of this cartoon. Two praying mantises, the female talking to the male, "After we have sex, but before I kill you, I'm going to need your help with some shelves." Or you learn in nature that tragedies become opportunities. So here's an old Larson cartoon. You kind of have to see it to see the humor, but there's three fish. They're at the edge of the ocean. There's a beach. One fish has a baseball bat under its flipper, and up on the beach is a baseball. And the title, the caption is "Great Moments in Evolution." So it's the disaster of the baseball out of the water. Who knew? You went into completely uncharted territory, and thanks to that, we're all here today. Good thing fish play baseball. So I'm just kind of funning you a little bit. Why not? One of the main things you learn in nature powerfully is impermanence. And the impermanence of pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. And we've just been blessed, you know, knock on wood, with 2 days like this. But it's very changeable, right? The weather's changeable. So you learn in nature to be exhilarated by all of the beauty. And in part, that beauty is really there, only there because of impermanence. How beautiful would a sunset be if it was just happening all day long? Impermanence in nature actually helps us appreciate the preciousness of things. We see the poignancy in things, the beauty in the poignancy, because it's all changing so much. But luckily, it's this big banquet of things, you know. And there's some steadiness. The ground is steady. The sky can be steady. And then there's a whole lot of change happening. So that's kind of like us. The ground is our steady awareness. Awareness is always available. Pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, mindfulness doesn't care. You can be aware of knee pain just as easily as you can be aware of bliss. From mindfulness perspective, they're equal. It's just something to be noticed. So this is how we start equalizing. We start being mindful of all of our experiences. So there's kind of a famous story about a famous teacher in the Thai forest tradition, Ajahn Chah, who was the abbot of the monastery where Jack Kornfield was a monk, where Ajahn Sumedho was a monk, many Westerners ordained. I was actually an anagarika, a kind of pre-novice monk at a nearby monastery for 3 months. So I have a lot of connection with the tradition. So Mark Epstein writes this. He's a Buddhist psychoanalyst. He writes about traveling in Asia in my early 20s with my American Buddhist teachers, Jack Kornfield, Joseph Goldstein, and Richard Alpert, or Ram Dass. I woke up after an all-night train ride from Bangkok to find myself in the forest monastery of a Thai meditation master named Ajahn Chah. Psychologically minded Westerners pillaging the wisdom of the East, trolling for some seed or shoot that might take root in American soil. We hurriedly constructed a question so as to generate a reply. I can no longer remember our question, but Ajahn Chah's response still lingers. Before saying a word, he motioned to a glass at his side. Do you see this glass? I love this glass. It holds the water admirably. When the sun shines on it, it reflects the light beautifully. When I tap it, it has a lovely ring. Yet for me, this glass is already broken. When the wind knocks it over or my elbow knocks it off the shelf and it falls to the ground and shatters, I say, of course. But when I understand that this glass is already broken, every minute of it, every minute with it is precious. That can sound like a bummer to start holding things in this way. This glass is already broken. This retreat is already broken. You know, this retreat is already over. It's, you know, it sounds like a bummer. But what it does is it bounces out our greed, you know, to things being pleasant, and allows us to actually accord with reality. You know, it's like reality's flowing through past us, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, and we're clinging on the rock, just hoping to stay in this kind of pleasant current. We just let go, and we can just go with the flow, go with the stream of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. How do we do that? We be mindful. You just wake up to pleasantness when it happens. You wake up to unpleasantness, and you wake up to neutral. And one thing we start to learn, the more mindful we become, the clearer we become about what's really happening. And the clearer we become about what works for us. One thing we become clear about is, yeah, when we go out in the woods, it is all changing and changeable, but we recognize something in us that feels completely resonant with being in the woods. The biologist E.O. Wilson calls it biophilia. You know, we didn't evolve in wood, brick buildings. We evolved like out in the woods. Our nervous systems are very happy. And we love the simple pleasures of sensory experience when our mind can freaking finally quiet down enough to let us just observe what's happening through our senses. It becomes vivid, doesn't it? Isn't the natural world feeling more vivid to you? Yes, no? Mm-hmm. Good. A lot of yeses. Yeah. We really like being in nature, in our senses, just watching simple things. If we just give ourselves permission that it's not just okay to do this, it's constructive to do this. It's okay to just sit idly by a river and watch the water. In fact, it's the path of awakening to do that. So here's a very famous poem called The Red Wheelbarrow by William Carlos Williams. It's like a haiku. So much depends upon a red wheelbarrow glazed with rainwater beside the white chickens. The end. So much depends on a red wheelbarrow glazed with rainwater beside the white chickens. Do you see the image? Do you see the red wheelbarrow? Do you see the white chickens? So much depends on it. Well, you can go, you know, online and read a zillion interpretations of this poem. And he wrote so many poems. He was a doctor and in his spare time was a poet. But I have my own interpretation. I mean, why does so much depend on a red wheelbarrow glazed with rainwater beside the white chickens? My interpretation from the perspective of our practice is suchness. Suchness is this Zen concept. I don't maybe know exactly what it means, but it's something about just pure being. We're just here being, we're in presence. And so whatever you put your sensory gaze upon becomes somehow filled with import. Like just watching a leaf twirl in an eddy and then find the current and go out into the current, right? You could almost have that feeling, like so much depends on this. But the depending is not on the object, it's on the seer. It's on the seeing. It's on the being. So much depends on this. We can really have that feeling. I just know I'm just at my happiest when my mind is quiet and I'm just in my senses, in my body. Not in that relentless kind of past and futuring of the brain. So, through nature, through connecting with it, and through making peace with pleasure and pain, we drop out of all of the clamor in our mind and we're just in our bodies and our senses. And then just being is the answer to all questions. Being itself is the meaning of being alive. Just being. So here's Crowfoot, a Blackfoot warrior and orator. Here's his answer to the question, what is life? What is life? It is the flash of the firefly in the night. It is the breath of a buffalo in the winter time. It is the little shadow that runs across the grass and loses itself in the sunset. He's so in his senses. Just being. Just being can be the meaning of existence. Just being. So let's sit for just a little bit. What is life? It is the flash of the firefly in the night. It is the breath of a buffalo in the winter time. It is the little shadow that runs across the grass and loses itself in the sunset.